people as were trustees of Carnegie Institute, the Art Museum and the Natural History Museum.
So you couldn't have trustees from, say, any other part of the country?
Couldn't have alumni as trustees.
Yeah.
But the executive committee only had to have a majority of its members as trustees.
Mm-hmm.
So we had several prominent alumni on the executive committee. One of them was old engine Charlie Wilson. He was a technologist,
mm-hmm.
and he was by that time Secretary of Defense. That'll tell you when this action got going. So Blanco and I said, let's go down and talk to Charlie Wilson about it. And so we did. We made a date, went down over at the War Defense Department and told my story to Charlie. He thought about it for a while. He said, I'll tell you what to do. You go back to Pittsburgh and tell those bastards that I'm coming to Pittsburgh. He named a month or 6 weeks, man. And I'm going to throw a big dinner at the Duquesne Club. I'm going to invite all of them. And I'll tell them what to do. Well, I came back with that news. And what happened? Dick Mellon, Bill Price, who was head of Westinghouse, and Jim Brevard, the chairman of the Board of Trustees, became the host for the dinner, and Charlie Wilson became the honored guest. And then things started to move. Ben Fairless took the chairmanship of the fund drive. God, what a guy he was. He had a private railway car, you know, and we would go down to Philadelphia, and he'd invite all of his friends to lunch or dinner at the Union League Club.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go to New York, same way, Cincinnati, Chicago, St. Louis, my God, Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
And his trick, he did the same thing with the big shots in Pittsburgh. He'd invite them to lunch up at the U.S. Steel dining room. And then his trick was always the same. He would say, well, gentlemen, I suspect you know what we're coming here for. Now, Jake, you tell them what we want them to do.
So he was really your real helper in
the fundraising. He was a real helper, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You still had to give the pitch, but yeah. He was right behind you.
That's right. What a wonderful guy he was. He's worth millions to us. We completed this campaign. In fact, we raised a good bit more than that. We won the complete affection of the Mellon families,
mm-hmm.
which had never been done before. They thought, you know, Carnegie had taken care of us. But I had become quite a good friend of Dick Mellon's. So we got I don't know how much money we got in. It was Sarah Scaife was Dick Mellon's sister. She was Art Lee's
Scaife?
S-C-A-I-F-E. Yeah, she married Alan Scaife, and she and Dick Mellon were the two richest people in Pittsburgh, of course, after R.B. and Andrew died. And Sarah Scaife she had a foundation and some family charitable trusts and so on. She built an engineering building for us. And Dick Mellon, Herb Simon, as an endowed a professorship that was endowed by Dick Mellon. And Dick Mellon is. I don't know how much he gives the school about $1 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the A.W. Mellon Trust, charitable trust, I got $5 million. An endowed professorship, $1 million a piece, for each department in the Fine Arts College. And then that was four. There were four departments. Then another visiting, endowed visiting professorship, so they could bring distinguished artists here that they couldn't bring on the faculty, that wouldn't, you know, that they couldn't hire as a permanent part. For example, I had Casals here one semester on this endowed professorship. I had, the name of the guy, a great city planner from England who planned the rebuilding of those towns that were bombed out during the war.
I don't know that name.
What's his name? Who stayed here, who stayed in America permanently.
Fuller.
He stayed on our faculty permanently until...
Not Fuller. Not Buckmeister Fuller.
No. But he's quite a famous guy. Well, that's the kind of guys. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are always people that are very stimulating to the faculty and the students both, these people.
No, they're very important for the modern university.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's the way it's been. I don't know how much money we raised, but the way it was just a new period in the history of Carnegie Tech about the money that came in over the transom, really. You know, it's just annual giving. It just changed the whole attitude of the community and the people all over the country and the alumni,
and it really made it into a national university.
That's right.
In a way that it wasn't before the war.
Right. Yeah. Well, this was a great experience for me, and I tell you, you can imagine how delighted I was and how much this did. This university just started going to town.
Yeah.
And now, this fellow Sire, not my successor, I left him. I left reserve funds amounting to $7 or $8 million, things that weren't at all committed, you know, like, of course, this doesn't include these endowed professorships or anything like that, because that's committed money. This is money that had no commitment on at all about how it's supposed to be spent. It was supposed to be in our drive. We raised it, I guess, $6 million of that as a fund to be used to support the budget in engineering science as needed. But anyway, there were something like $7 or $8 million in these reserve funds when Stever took over. He was president 6 years, I think. Six, seven at the most. The last couple of years he was there, he had spent all these reserve funds, and he was running deficits of $2 million a year. Then the trustees blew the whistle. He went to Washington. He went to Washington as director of the National Science Foundation. Then they made Sire dean. He's been a good dean. He got the university.
What was his name?
Cyert. He's a University of Minnesota boy who did his doctorate at Columbia in economics. And I think in management science too. I think he's a very bright guy. And he's turned out to be a damn good administrator and businessman. He got the school back in the black the first year he was president without having anybody commit suicide or anything, or having to reduce salaries. He just took a national attrition for a year or two, and he started a campaign. His campaign was $100 million. And it finished successfully.
Yeah.
You see how much easier it becomes all the time. And here, I suppose his $100 million isn't worth much more than my $50 was.
It might be worth closer to $30 million or so, depending on buying power.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you a question we touched upon earlier in your study, and that is, what is your vision of the modern American university? What do you think it should do, and what do you think it shouldn't do? Because you definitely raised the money, and once you got the money, you did something with it.
Well, you want my ideal of what a good university ought to be? a general sort of all-inclusive statement is, it should be a center of learning. I think this means it has to do good teaching and it has to do good scholarly research. I don't think it wants to be the slave of any segment of our society. I think it wants to be independent. I think it'd be a disaster if a good university started doing secret work for the government. If the university has scholars that are important for the national security, it's always a way, without degrading the university, there's always a way of letting their knowledge be used for the national security. They can be consultants to Los Alamos or Oak Ridge. They can take leave for a year if they're particularly important for some project. But you don't have to use their talents by doing secret work on a campus. I think they have to be the source of basic new knowledge. I'm not talking about technology or I like it when university professors will do something of use to society once in a while. I don't like guys that, like Harold Urey, when he came back from Europe one time, was being interviewed, and he said, "I'm glad to tell you that research I do couldn't possibly be of any practical importance." That, in my mind, is not a proper, honest attitude for a good scholar. I think you ought to be glad if some of your ideas are useful to society.
So you feel that the student, say the undergraduate student, or the graduate student for that matter, at Carnegie Tech during your period, if you'd like to see what that person takes away with him when he leaves, it would be really pretty much an excellence in his understanding of pure science.
That's
in
right.
That in that field, and leave it for the employer or the job situation to create an opportunity to use
that's
it
right.
in a technological society, really.
You know, some very well-trained basic scholars, once they have finished their education, well, you never finish your education, it's obvious. You have to keep, if you're going to be a scholar, you're always a scholar. But the market will take care of some of this. Suppose the fellow has been studying and doing research and of a very basic character for his doctorate, maybe even a year of postdoctorate work or two, and then takes a job with Merck or with Allied or with Monsanto. If he sees the high salaries coming to people who can and will do some applied research, well, he won't be so damn particular about what he does.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think you're right. The market often will determine which, but also you can't learn pure science outside the university. It's very hard to do.
A lot of people learn a lot of it on their own. God knows I did, but it's not easy.
It's not ideal, anyway.
No, sir. It's not the time. You ought to be. I shouldn't have had to spend 6 or 7 years just learning the modern state of physical science. It means that my graduate years are pretty largely wasted, and so are my undergraduate days.
Well, it was during this period of your presidency, not only were you had effective arguments for this, the goals of the National University is what you called it,
mm-hmm.
And you also were very busy, and it's the presidency, president's position. You serving, beginning to serve on a whole lot of different corporate boards and the like, and I was wondering if you had some that were of particular interest to you and were rewarding. Or?
Most of them were rewarding. The first substantial board I was on was the J&L, Jones and Laughlin. I went on that, I think, the first year I became president. And I was on it until, well, after I had retired. I guess I had a retirement age of 72, which means I was on from 65 to 72 after I had retired. And I was kept on as a consultant after that for several years. Mm-hmm. I was what you'd call a science member of the J&L board. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to follow what they were building. They did build a quite a big research laboratory while I was on the board. And I was talked to a lot by their director of research, Herb Graham, in planning the thing and collecting his staff and what kinds of things they were going to do. You see, this came after I'd had some experience in the metallurgy field. And when I went into metallurgy, I thought, well, I'm going to start program on physical chemistry, metallurgical reactions, and teach a graduate course in this subject. I better find out how steel is actually made. Well, I went out to Homestead, old number 4 open house, where I knew the superintendent, and where one of my former students, Max Leitner, was the assistant superintendent. And I actually lived with him for a month or two, and then I went down to the next summer. I went down and spent a month at IMCO at Middletown High, actually helping in experiments that were being done out in the open house floor. I don't know whether the name John Chipman means anything to you.
No.
Well, John was he wound up his career as professor and head of metallurgy at MIT. He was a physical chemist from Berkeley, mm-hmm. who went into metallurgy at the University of Michigan after he got his doctorate, and he became probably the best known man in America on the physical chemistry of steelmaking reactions. And I knew John. I don't know how we first got acquainted. He was at Michigan, and then he went from there to being associate director of research for ARMCO. We had quite a lot of, you see, Bob Mayle had been associate director, then came back, and here's Johnny Chipman that I knew became, well, and he was doing a lot of these metal slag equilibrium studies by taking samples out of the open hearth, you know, while steel was being made, and I would help break the slag skull off of these ladles that we took samples out with, and worked like a regular member of their research staff or their lab staff.
And this is while you're president of
No, this is back in the period of 36 to 38.
Oh, okay, way back then.
When I was on the metallurgy faculty, for 2 years.
So you were really a board member of Jones and Lawton that knew.
I knew something about it. Of course, I knew him electrochemistry. Let me help him on a lot of corrosion and coating problems. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed that very much. And then next, Pittsburgh Plate Glass, now PPG Industries, invited me to come on. That was a good experience, too. I liked that. And the other, next large one, was Travail Corporation. I don't think that's in the
new... How do you spell that?
D-R-A-V-O.
Oh, yes, okay. I know they're a local Pittsburgh company.
Yeah. Well, pretty much a national, international company now. They've had this depression has hit them pretty hard. you know, the kind of, they're heavy contractors, steel mills and various metallurgical builders of metallurgical plants, builders of dams and docks and bridge piers and all that kind of, diggers of tunnels.
Yeah.
I was on their board for I don't know how many years, and I enjoyed it. I didn't know. I wasn't as helpful. My background didn't help Gravel Corporation nearly as much as it helped J&L and PPG Industries. See, PPG is pretty diversified. Not just a glass company. It's damn near. It's almost a third glass, maybe a little over a third glass, but roughly a third glass, a third chemicals, and a third coatings and resin. Mm-hmm. I guess if you put the glass fiber in with the glass, it would be a good bit over a third. It would be more like 40%, 40-45% glass and glass fiber. So I knew I could be helpful on a lot of problems at PPG. Then there were a bunch of smaller companies that I was in.
Right, Magnetics.
Magnetics was interesting. It was an outfit up here at Butler, started by Art. It was bought up after I'd been on it for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, by Spang and Company. And I became a director of Spang and Company.
Spang?
S-P-A-N-G, yeah. It's a privately owned company by the Spang family and some of the employees. I think they were a little ahead of Spang and Company now. There was a student of mine, Frank Rath. He was a student in the days when the Big Depression was on, you know, back in 29-33. And Frank worked in my lab on a WPA sort of deal, you know, washing dishes and cleaning up.
Glassware and the like.
When he graduated, I don't know what he must have graduated in metallurgy because he went to work for U.S. Steel. And he left. Then he married a Spang daughter.
Well, that's a good way to
marry the boss's daughter. And he now, the Spang family, as far as boys, has run out. So Frank is now the chief executive officer of Spang and Company. It was a funny situation because I think Frank Rath was a little unethically when he got a hold of Magnetics. I never liked Frank too well since then.
Mm-hmm.
And I helped Frank some after I went on the Spang board, but that was because the only Spang, elder Spang, remember there were brothers, two or three brothers that started this company. They were all either dead. There was one of them still living. He was so old, he'd come to a board meeting. He'd go to sleep in a board meeting. So I proposed to Frank, good, damn it, why don't you get a retirement age for board of directors of the company? They have a retirement age at PPG, at J&L, Gravel. So why not get rid of this guy? Or if you don't want to apply it to him, put a grandfather clause in. But get the thing cleaned up. He did.
Mm-hmm.
But Frank made some bad deals for Spang and Company. He bought up Sun Drug, another discount place, and put them together as Spang Stores. And I think they had to just write off all of it for this time. They're manufacturers of a bunch of oil well drilling equipment, and they also recover. I guess they got their start by recovering metal from slag in the steel companies. And preparing a slag, you know, sizing it, grinding it, or breaking it. But anyway, that's enough of that.
No.
Nuclear science and engineering was bought out by, they got a very hot internal political fight going on that. I was on the board when this thing came up. A couple of people who had put up a good bit of the money and owned a good bit of the stock started trying to get complete control of the thing. Made it some very dirty tricks to the management. The guy who really had started it and was running it was a guy who had split off from Westinghouse from their atomic program at Pettus Field.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, I don't know, they tried to try to get rid of him, you know. Well, I was so unhappy with the way the whole thing was going, I just resigned from the board. I was chairman of the board, I resigned from them. Well, it was picked up then by this international pharmaceutical company, a guy by the name of Panic is the head of it. Have you ever heard of that?
No, no.
Well, it's a good name for a
Panic?
Name.
Panic? P-A-N-I-K? Or?
I see.
I wouldn't want to work for him, I think. I think I'd worry about that for a while.
He offered to buy all outstanding stock at a bargain price, of course, for him. So I decided, hell, I don't have much invested in this. I had a few, maybe 500 shares or something like that. I don't know what I'd pay for them, maybe $2.50 a share. And I decided, I don't know whether this guy is a genius or a damn fool, but I'm not going to sell my shares back to him as a bargain price. I'm just going to divide them equally between my two boys and tell them, just hang on to this forever and see whether it ever amounts to anything. So they still have these shares.
Panic.
Well, let me tell you something else. You noticed that I was on the research advisory board of city service.
Right.
Well, they paid a nice salary. I think we had 4 meetings a year or something like that. Well, I think they paid us $5,000 a meeting, something like that. Maybe it was $5,000 a year, but I don't know. It was juicy anyway. All expenses and the... But that was the one thing that wasn't mentioned in the biography. I was on the Westinghouse Research Advisory Board for a number of years. They pay all of these directorships and advisory boards pay a good stipend, you know. And that's the reason the Warner family got pretty rich. My dear wife was a honors graduate, Phi Beta Kappa in economics. She was the bookkeeper and controller of the Warner family.
Mm-hmm.
She had very cute ideas. After I began to earn a decent salary and had a number of consulting jobs, she said, "Now look, Jay, you know very well that we can live on your salary. Let's start an investment, another bank account, which will be our investment account. And all of your consulting fees, all of your dividends on stock you already have, all of your fees like Westinghouse Advisory Board, this goes in the investment account. And all of our dividends from our investments will go in the investment account." And I said, "Yes, but this income, I have to pay income tax on it." "Oh, we'd pay the income tax out of your regular salary."
I was going to ask you, this is actually a good time to bring it up, but I find that many times when I speak with eminent chemists and chemical engineers about their careers, their wives played a great role. And it's something, of course, that they never get credit for. You know, it was
right
behind them all the time is their wives who are doing things for them. Or what. And you just mentioned your wife as kind of being the great kind of financial wizard behind the behind the operation. What else? Can you tell me some more about her? Or, some more about some of the just some of the ways she helped you and
she was a wonderful woman. We were for the last 4 years were declining health, and I really devoted myself more and more to taking care of her. She, when we moved out here, she was a wheelchair case, but she still had this exuberance. And you introduce her to anyone. If she'd been down at lunch today and you introduced her to anyone, her face still lighted up, you know, vivacious. She was kind of, people thought she was one of the most friendly people, and still she never buttered into anybody's affairs. She wouldn't have anything to do with gossip. She was just, we were still in love after 55 years, I'll tell you. He was great.
And she was so helpful to you when you were the president of the university, isn't it?
Oh, she was a wonderful presence for us. Oh, yeah. And, my God, what a recognition the people on the campus have given her. A dedication. Scaife, Mrs. Scaife, I told you, gave me that engineering building. After this campaign was all over,